problem, you know, with the towers themselves, the preforms work. You know, the price was right, that's why I used them, and no problems. I did have stretch on a couple of them from the hurricanes. Let me drop it.
By the way, that's
I did have a little bit of stretch on one, which I replaced, but the stretched one managed to hold it up through a subsequent hurricane that came like a couple of weeks later. So, also, I'm changing out guy wires. They've been up since 1988. The ocean is not a problem here, but the higher you go, the more surface rust there is. Only on the tops of the wires. There's no structural. There's no compromising there in the strength or anything. The birds and the air and the static up there is worn off the gal from the top of the wires. Let me drop it. If you're going to paint guy wire, paint it before you put it on, and spraying is a waste of paint. If you want to coat paint wire, I paint some of my dipoles white if the wire is black. Of course, it's free. But anyway, you throw it in a bucket of paint and twirl it around, and that way everything gets evenly painted and you get more efficient use of the paint. So I'm painting my tower in the next few weeks. We're changing out the top two guy sets because they're the only ones that have rust on them after 1988. And the painting glove you can buy at Home Depot. I think they were like $6 a piece. I've got one for white and one for orange. And I wear a rubber glove so I don't have to deal with latex paint getting on my skin because the painting mitt is not rubber lined. Back to you, Dick. K2 RIW from K4 NBC.
Very fine, Bob. That guy wire that stretched, did the preform allow the wire to slip a little bit? Somehow I doubt it. Somehow I think the guy wire was itself stretched because of being pushed near the deflection limit, if you know what I mean. I'm having trouble believing that the preform allowed it to slip and yet didn't let go all the way. And the one that did slip, I'm very glad to hear that you're using guy clips on the ends of your preforms as a belt and suspenders. Once you understand how the theory of operation of that thing, it's sort of like a Chinese finger torture. The guy clip at the far end of the preform gives you a tremendous force multiplication as to how well it can hold onto a guy wire. So that one that slipped, you said slipped. I think you really mean the guy wire itself stretched. I've also had a guy wire stretch because a tree fell against it, and I didn't trust it after that and replaced it. And be careful when you're replacing guy wires. I know you know that you got to put a new guy wire on first before you're removing the old one. You'd be amazed how many people get a failure in the process of replacing guy wires. K4 NBC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, and there is another gentleman in the wings there waiting. That's a good idea, you know. Next time I'll try that. Hey, Dick, would it be a good idea to loosen the guy wire, remove the guy wire from the ground end with nobody on the tower, or should I be on the tower when I remove one of the guy wires?
As you guys know, if you get the ARRL letter, there was a tower removing operation that took place in the Midwest a week or two ago, in which a tall tower was being taken down. They were down to the 30-foot level. Two guys were on the tower. Two human beings were on the tower. And the ground crew was disconnecting guy wires. And the ground crew, as I've heard this story so many times, the ground crew got ahead of the guys of the human beings on the tower. And the net result was that the tower fell over with two human beings on the top at the 30-foot level. And they fell over in such a way that the tower fell on top of them once they hit the ground. One man died, the other man was very heavily injured. And the way it was explained is that the wind blew over the tower. Come on. That's a nice, friendly way of explaining it. It really was an improperly run operation. The guy wires are what does everything on a tower. Let me drop. There are people who make the mistake of thinking, well, I've got X number of tons of concrete at the base of the tower. It can't possibly fall over. Come on. When a tower's been up for a long time and you're taking it down, those legs at the base right where it enters the concrete could be heavily rusted in ways that don't show. The guy wires are what really keep a tower vertical. You can have a zillion pounds of concrete at the bottom, and depending on the slenderness ratio of the tower, if it doesn't look like an Eiffel Tower, then the guy wires are doing everything. And these guys should have been putting on a second set of temporary guys at the 20-foot or 15-foot level before disconnecting the ones at the 30-foot level. That was a very foolish operation. To blame it on the wind makes it sound nice, but in reality, there was a lot of pilot error in this particular operation. I wonder if you read that report, Bob. And there's a real set of lessons to be learned here. K4NBC for any comments. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, we're on the exact same wavelength here. That's exactly what I was thinking of, and it almost mirrors a... well, I would call it a landmark, lawsuit, but once upon a time, this guy was taking a tower down that was on a building for many years. It was a Rome 25 tower. I think it was like 100 feet. And the owner of the building hired these handyman-type guys to take it down or something. Anyway, he got up there from the top of the tower, and he removed the guy wire, and down and over he went into the power line. He got killed. Rome got sued, and that is why today, whenever you buy even a bolt from Rome, they'll give you a sign that says, you know, warning: power work is dangerous. Blah 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 blah. So that's exactly what I was thinking of, and history repeats itself.
Now, Doug also recognized the tallest tower on planet Earth was the Radio 1 tower in Poland up until the mid-90s. And the lowest bidder got the job to replace the rusting guy wires, and they did something in the wrong order and collapsed this 2,250-foot-high, roughly, structure. The tallest man-made structure on planet Earth was that particular tower. And after that, the local community in Poland lost the faith. The zoning board did not give them permission to put it back up. They've had nowhere near the coverage ever since. Radio 1 had this tallest tower for about a 25-year period of time and never bragged about it. And my goodness, what a series of errors took place there. I think it was one person before Doug who wanted to make a comment. Who was that person? Give me your call letters and your comment right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, you got a minute, W2YY, with a question for K4NBC.
Okay. Doug, go right ahead with your comment, and then we'll pick up Joe in that order. Go ahead, W2SAY, K2RIW.
Hey, WA2SAY again. Question on the length of the guy wires. I am going to have a 20-meter rotatable dipole on top of this rotator, which is going to be held by the guy wires. I realize that certain lengths of guy wire could interfere with the pattern of the dipole, but what length? Is it a quarter wave, a half wave, or multiples of a quarter, or what is the... is the critical length that I have to avoid?
In my opinion, Doug, there is no critical length you have to avoid. And I'm going to give an explanation on this. The super conservative people have come up with all kinds of fancy mathematics where they break up the guy wire in a zillion places with egg insulators to make sure there's no resonance on any of the frequencies and any of the harmonics of the frequencies, and they go wild with that. The chances of you having a guy wire that's just the right length that it disturbs the pattern of your 20-meter beam is very slim. And even if you hit that magic length, all you'd have to do is somewhere near the middle of the guy wire hang an auxiliary piece of wire that goes nowhere, if you know what I mean, off at some crazy angle, and you would immediately detune it. And don't worry about that. People worry much too much about the guy wires. They're really away from the antenna. They're at a crazy angle. Their effective capture area is extremely small unless you happen to hit resonance. The resonance is a difficult thing to calculate because it depends on the amount of capacitance you're adding to the end. You got a great big screw anchor at one end. You've got the tower itself on the other end. And electronically, what is that length is very difficult to predict. You could model it. Don't worry about it. If there's one chance in 100, you're going to run into a resonance. And when you do, it's a very easy thing to kill that resonance. Joe had a quick question on some subject like this. W2RYY, K2RYW. Go ahead, Joe.
No, I had a quick question for K4NBC. It's not related to this subject. Can I ask him something quickly?
Go ahead, Joe.
Hi, K4NBC, W2RYY. You mentioned a couple of weeks ago about a location of a station called a paid-for station in Florida. Could you give me the location of that again? I was not quick enough to write it down last time you mentioned it. You said the one in Georgia closed, I guess, a couple of years ago, but there was one station in Florida still operating. Could you tell me where that is?
Still operating what? And talk faster. You said you wanted to ask me a question quickly.
I thought I did ask you a question. Do you know where the location of the pay-for station is in Florida?
McDill.
Say that again. I didn't catch that.
McDill Air Force Base.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, there's a pay for it.
And also, don't worry, I know a guy who, he had a tri-band beam up about 50 feet, and he spent some pretty good money on Philly's brand guy wires, and he changed out his steel guy wires, in fact, the same stuff that I'm using, the Philly strand, and then when he was getting signal checks from everybody, they were the same.
Yeah, in theory, Philly strand, a thoroughly Kevlar-type guy wire, is a thoroughly insulated device, and you think you're going to get away from all electrical properties. If the tower itself is being fed as a monopole, similar to an AM broadcast station, maybe there's some advantage in the Philly strand. But for the average radio amateur on HF and VHF frequencies, I don't think there's an advantage. And the Philly strand itself is a real art form to properly install those holding devices on the end of the Philly strand in order to develop the full strength. And the smart people in the Midwest make sure that the bottom 20 feet or 30 feet of the guy wire is metallic and the rest of it is Philly strand, because if a range fire takes place, a grass fire, the Philly strand melts and the tower falls over. On top of that, it's a very unpleasant thought to think about the fact that if a child walks over to your tower with a razor blade in his hand and he scrapes it across the Philly strand, he cuts through your guy wire, and that's going to frost you. So I'm a real strong believer in ordinary seven strand, extremely high strength type guy wires. Galvanized coated is my favorite. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in, so it's time for your mailbag, Mel. What kind of burning questions have we had this week? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY again. Well, first of all, got an update here. Ham radio operators are some of the finest people in this world. I can testify to this. Okay, this is the person that last week, I told you about this gentleman bought a commercial 40-meter dipole, put it up exactly the way they constructed it, step-by-step, put it up in the clear and everything. And if you remember that when he hooked a fairly new transceiver, high-end transceiver to it, the rig shut down. And eventually he had a friend come over with his transceiver, and it worked. And do you remember that situation, Dick? Over.
I sure do, Mel, and we all felt for him. We all identified with his problem. He's a guy fairly new to electronics. The rig just wouldn't behave correctly no matter what he did, and it defied all all reasonable logic, and we did give him a pretty long list of suggestions with reference to dummy loads and taking his rig over to somebody else's house and whatever, a whole series of suggestions we had, and told him, don't give up so easily. I hope he was able to take some of those suggestions, and I hope something finally works. So what's the second half of the story, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, a ham that was listening called him, drove 12 miles, he said, picked him up with the rig, took him to his home, his QTH, hooked it up and found the same problem with the rig. The guy looked at it, he put his dummy load on, the rig worked perfect. Now, he shipped the rig, previously, if you remember, what I had said previously, to last week, he had shipped the rig also to the manufacturer, who said there was nothing wrong with the rig. Well, anyhow, this person drove him back. He called, he had recommended one of the distributors, that's a very popular company, good company to deal with, and he took it to their place where they sell the equipment, and they hooked it up to first the dummy load, rig performed and loaded up properly, and they hooked it to an antenna that they have there. He begged them, get on 40 meters or whatever, just show me, make one contact. Guess what? They could not make it work, Dick, over.
Fantastic. And what I was predicting, Mel, the only difference between a dummy load and a real antenna is that a real antenna puts some extra signal on the outside of the coax cable. And there's something about that particular rig. Maybe the microphone cord is not properly RF bypassed, or the Morse code key wiring is not properly bypassed. Somehow, RF energy on the outside of that rig is false alarming the standing wave ratio detecting circuitry. That's what we were predicting last week. And so a whole series of experiments are now going to have to take place, unplugging the microphone, making it run from a Morse code key, or some rigs, even without a Morse code key, without a microphone plugged in, you can flip a switch on the front panel to put it into the test mode. We were also suggesting that when it's going into an antenna and tripping out, instead of running it at the 1-watt level, running it at the 100-watt level, run it at the 1-watt level and see if it still trips out. At what power level does it trip out into what kind of an antenna? There's a whole series of experiments, but at least the guy is getting confirmation. He now knows he's not crazy, and he knows that there's something very peculiar about that rig. So is there another chapter coming to the story? I bet there is. W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
This is K-2-K-E-Y. Yes, there is more to the story. And here it is. Here he is at the distributor. And he says they were, after 15 minutes, the gentleman that was testing out the radio, tried all kinds of things, scratched his head. 15 minutes later, he was rubbing his eyes. Then there was some phone calls. He got on the phone. He says, wait a minute. And there was some phone calls going back and forth. 15 minutes after that, he says, gentleman from the back of the place came out of, I guess he says, the warehouse with a brand new rig in the box. He took home the new rig. The same rig, brand new. They exchanged it for him. Very unusual to hear this. Plugged it in, hooked it to his antenna, and 15 minutes later made his first contact on 40 meters with the United Kingdom, and after that for Germany, telling me, hey, gave me all this to BX. Never had another problem, he says. In the last few days, he says, I've been operating it with no problem. I have no idea what was wrong with that radio, but they seem like they couldn't either figure this out. Why does radio work perfectly into a dummy load, but will not work into any kind of antenna? New rig, no problem. Over.
Fantastic. So I have the impression that he brought it back to the dealership where he bought it, or he brought it to a dealership that covers the same brand name. Most likely that was the dealership where he purchased it. And so I guess we're learning a lesson by this one. In some cases, you're better off bringing it back to the dealer rather than send it back to the factory, because all the factory's going to do is connect it to a dummy load. I've had a number of non-confirmed reports in my case where a particular rig, an ICOM rig, the push to talk button was unreliable, and the factory thought it was a non-confirmed complaint, and shipped me back the rig with a brand new microphone. Well, the microphone wasn't the problem. It was a very marginal circuit inside the rig itself that operates off the push to talk button on the microphone. So it wasn't the microphone, and the circuit itself was marginal. So I guess he did go back to the dealer where he bought it, and that looks like it worked out like a charm. Back to you, Mel, for a confirmation on that.
Yep, believe it or not, some of them even volunteered to take them. They rode more than 1 hour to get to the dealership to bring it there in person, because I guess he was at the end of his wits. But I know this dealership, I will highly recommend a Tam Radio Outlet, HRO, and they are sometimes really go out of their way for Ham Radio operators. So I know I shouldn't give them a plug, but they went out of their way to help this gentleman over.
Sounds like we got a happy ending to that story, Mel. Well done. And so I guess some of the hints that he was getting from some of the people on the TechNet allowed him to hang in there, as opposed to giving up the hobby. Sounds like he was on the threshold of giving up the hobby. And yes, that's an extremely unusual set of circumstances. And I'd love to see a really smart group of people investigating that rig. What was the problem? And I'm not hearing the sound of anyone having tried to operate it at the 1 watt level instead of the 100 watt level into a real antenna to see if it tripped out. That would give you a couple of more hints as to what's going on. The dummy load is not enough. Okay, why don't you go to another one of your questions, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, well, according to what I heard, they could not make the rig work, period. He tried. Now, this gentleman, he's familiar with you. They sell these radios, and they demonstrate them and everything. And they tried everything just to get this thing. It would not work into an antenna under any circumstances, but performed exactly with a tummy load. You got me, Dick. I am as lost as you. I guess this is strictly up to, you'd have to get a C, but I guess you'll never know. I'm sure the rig went right back to the manufacturer somewhere, either maybe in Japan. All right, let's see. Should we try one more?
I think we should. And it's a little bit unfortunate that we don't get a feedback on that one. I'm also worried that that particular rig goes back to the factory, and if somebody doesn't give them a great big long report that they really believe and really read, they will again call it a non-confirmed complaint. The rig will get shipped to somebody else. And that poor rig can go around and around and around a whole lot of times. Craziness. Go ahead with your next mailbag. Sounds like we've had some success on that one, Mel. Go ahead with your next question.
They may look into it and find out what heck happened, or it may wind up being crushed, as they've done with a number of cars, because that's what happens. Some manufacturers sometimes get what they call it, one of those situations where it's, I got one of those, years ago you used to talk about those type of things happening. And then when the manufacturer finally take back the pink elephant, or whatever they wanted to call it at the time, they disappeared. Because my brother was involved with a very large scrap company here in Brooklyn, and he says they saw a number of times where they took, for one reason or another, they processed automobiles, brand new automobiles from Chrysler. They brought them there, and they made sure they stood there while they were put into a big squeeze into the compactor. For what reason or another, why brand new cars sometimes, would be, also, like I say, just done away with rather than something is just not right. I guess maybe they did the same thing with the rig, Dick, over.
Yeah, but there's a real science experiment that should be run there to find out what's going on. And with and without the mic plug-in would be my first guess. Serious test of how many milliohms of resistance was there between the output connector and the chassis. I mean, there's a slim possibility the darn UHF output connector was floating from the chassis, if you know what I mean. And there's a whole lot of crazy things that could have happened with an expensive rig that's rare. But here's a poor guy who is new to ham radio, wasn't used to these things, and unfair that he should be subjected to that. Go ahead with a real question, Mel.
Hey, yeah, all right. I guess these things do happen. Whether or not they investigate, that's something else I cannot answer. All right. What is... Okay, here's an interesting one. I never even heard this. I'm not even sure I even heard this ever in radio, really. What is knife? K-N-I-F-E. Knife, yeah. Knife edge subtraction. Did you ever hear this one, Dick? Over.
Absolutely. Lots of times I've heard that one. The best example you can look at that you would understand is to recognize, first of all, that whether you're talking about 60 cycle, HF radio, microwave radio, infrared, optical, or ultraviolet, it's all the same spectrum. You're just changing the frequency or changing the wavelength. If you're in an extremely dark room, and you've got a single point source of light, and you're holding a razor blade in your hand, and you're holding the razor blade in such a way that the source of light is directly behind the razor blade. In other words, the razor blade is blocking your line of sight between your eye and that point source of light in a dark room. And you look at the edge, the sharp edge of the razor blade, and you'll see that it's glowing. There's a funny phenomenon when you've got a sharp edge and what you think is a blockage, the signal flows around that sharp edge. The radar cross-section people call it the Keller effect. It's called knife edge diffraction. But under certain circumstances, you get a lot of signal coupled across that sharp edge in a crazy way that defies the normal blockage. You could have a hogback. Let me drop. You could have a ridge line along a mountain range that's sometimes called a hogback, and in one valley you've got a transmitter, in the other valley you've got a guy that wants to do some reception, and they both aim their antennas up at that hogback, the sharp edge of the top of the mountain that's got some real... let's assume now that the two guys are separated from each other in a north-south direction, and the hogback, the sharp edge of the mountain, is an east-west running mountain, sharp edge. And you both aim your antennas at that sharp edge, and you'd be amazed how much signal goes over that sharp edge. That's called knife edge diffraction. How can a signal get from point A to point B? It can get there by reflection, refraction, or diffraction. And this is called diffraction. So sharp edges, knife edge diffraction, will give you a propagation, and there's a... once you know the word and the proper spelling, and you Google those words, you'll find articles that'll explain it, and they'll show you graphs of how it works. So it does really exist, and I know some microwave people who have used it, particularly in places like California. The 10-gig people use it relatively frequently during a 10-gig contest in California. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, I can now picture what they're talking about. In other words, when the radio wave passes over the sharp edge of the mountain, a portion of the wave is sort of, like you say, is, well, gee, would it flow, you know, something? Wait, picture this. If it would pass over, say, the edge of the hilltop, a portion of that wave adjacent to the edge, in other words, would it change the way the wave is moving, like change its speed? Would it actually be able to slow the wave down, Dick, because of that sharp edge effect? Or am I going off the wrong direction? Over.
If it did slow it down, and there's various ways that the terrain could give you a slow wave structure, if it did slow it down, that would be called... that would be called refraction, not diffraction. That would be refraction. Now, diffraction is a kind of absorption. It's a kind of absorption and re-radiation, Mel. There's something about a sharp edge where you can excite the signal on that sharp edge. It gets absorbed and re-radiated, and you still suffer some loss. In other words, The knife edge diffracted signal is going to be, let me pick a number, 20 decibels weaker than a direct line of sight signal. But still, that's 80 dB stronger than a thoroughly blocked signal, if you know what I mean. So, although you suffer some attenuation with knife edge diffraction, it still is a hell of a lot stronger than many of the alternatives with that particular terrain setup. I know that the GTE Lenkert set of books on microwave propagation covered this. I know there's going to be some websites, probably there's a Wikipedia, describing knife edge diffraction. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, you mentioned microwave. Would we ever be able to see any effect on, say, UHF or VHF of this type of effect, Dick, over?
And the answer is absolutely yes. If you know what to look for on VHF and UHF, you're going to see it, without a doubt. If, for instance, you and I were north-south displaced from each other, you're in a valley on the north side of the mountain, I'm in a valley on the south side of the mountain, and the mountain has just the right kind of terrain across the top, and you aim your VHF antenna at the top of that mountain, I aim my VHF antenna at the top of the mountain, and we study what signal strength we're going to get. Based on the number of miles between you and the top of the mountain, the number of miles between me and the top of the mountain, we calculate how much free space path loss there would be. We know that the mountain is a complete blockage between us. In theory, if we were using simple line of sight characteristics, there would be no signal going from your valley to my valley. But we both aim at the top of the mountain, and we will definitely see a signal. And you go through the calculations, and you're going to find out that the knife edge diffraction is something like 20 decibels more loss than free space. But still, that's a hell of a lot more signal strength than you would get if the knife edge diffraction was not there. W2SA, K2KEY. I keep wanting to call you Doug tonight. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, sounds like a fascinating, something in communication. Knife edge diffraction. Got to keep that in mind. All right, should we try jam in one more?
Go for it.
Okay, there's one. I'm trying to find something, of interest to everybody. Many young people write in different things. I got a new transceiver, and it says that it has a new enhanced limiter circuit. What exactly is the limiter doing in the FM receiver section or transceiver? And can you explain just basically what a limiter in simple words is, over?
Yeah, I'm going to give you a couple of words on what I think a limiter is, and then you probably have some words also. If this was the most ideal FM receiver in the world, knowing that an FM modulated signal is swishing up and down in frequency in a manner proportional to the peaks and valleys of the voltage coming out of the microphone when I speak into it. So the voltage coming out of the microphone operates on a voltage-controlled oscillator. That's one way of doing it. And then the frequency is being swished up and down. So in theory, a FM-modulated signal has absolutely no change in the amplitude of the signal. The only thing that's changing is the instantaneous frequency going up and down, higher and lower. The positive peaks of my voice make the frequency go up. The negative peaks of my voice, voltage coming out of the microphone, make the frequency go down. And if this is the most ideal FM receiver in the world, it's looking for those frequency changes, and it has no response to any amplitude change. Let me drop. But now let's go to the real world. In the real world, an airplane is flying overhead and it's giving you a fluttering effect because it's a direct signal and there's a signal bouncing off the airplane. So therefore, the instantaneous amplitude of the FM modulated signal getting to my receiver is going up and down. A car is driving, and another thing that's going on is that an automobile is driving out in front and it's got a transistorized ignition system that's real loud. And the neighbor is running his really yucky, noisy lawnmower. And the lawnmower is got a very noisy ignition system. So there's all kinds of staticky-like signals, amplitude-modulated signals, and whatever, that get into your FM receiver. And whether using a ratio detector, a Foster-Seeley discriminator, whatever you're using as the final detection stage of your FM receiver, they all have a little bit of amplitude sensitivity. They're not supposed to, but they do. So by putting something in front called limiter, you're taking the signal going in, you're putting it through a high-gain amplifier. The high-gain amplifier has something like a clipping circuit on the output, which is taking all of that beautiful, if your IF strip happens to be operating at 10.7 megacycle, it's taking that beautiful 10.7 megacycle sine wave and converting it into 10.7 megacycle square wave. And the way the square wave limiter circuit works is that all the square waves coming out have exactly the same amplitude. It might be plus or minus 1 volt, if you know what I mean. So now your receiver is going to be having almost no response to that airplane flying over, giving you a fluttering amplitude, and very little response to the ignition static from the noisy automobile or the noisy lawnmower and so on. So when you put in a properly operating limiter circuit, the fidelity of what you...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Get a good reel, put a real good limiter circuit in front of the discriminator, the frequency discriminator, and the fidelity of what you hear sounds a lot better. You hear less noise, you hear less flutter, there's no amplitude modulation, and so on. You get some definite benefits. However, if you now want to go the next step, there is something called the CIFAR circuit. The radar people developed something called constant false alarm rate. Also, the NEMS clock company used to be a manufacturer of Cadillac receivers in the 1960s, located in Maryland. The NEMS clock company made some very fancy FM receivers where they were not using one limiter stage, they were using three cascaded limiter stages. The first limiter stage was relatively broadband in frequency bandwidth. The next stage was a little bit more narrow band, and the third stage of limiting was more narrow band left yet, and then became the frequency discriminator. A limiter has some other peculiar characteristics called the capture effect. If you've got two signals coming into your receiver simultaneously, you're listening to QXR from the Empire State Building in New York City in the old days, and because there's a band opening on that exact same frequency, there's another FM broadcast station coming in from Chicago. And the Chicago station is 6 dB weaker than the one from the Empire State Building. An ordinary FM receiver is going to hear some staticky effects from that Chicago station. You use that NEMS clock receiver, and it had a very high capture ratio such that if the weaker signal was 0.997 of the voltage of the stronger signal, 0.997 is in voltage, I don't know the exact number, it's probably a tenth of a dB weaker. Because of that cascaded various bandwidth discriminator technique with its high capture ratio, the weaker signal would be suppressed by 20 decibels coming out of the loudspeaker.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Even though the weaker signal going into the receiver was only a tenth of a dB weaker. So very high capture ratio effects are possible when you really have properly operating state-of-the-art limiter stages. So mathematically how a limiter works, if you study the book called Lectures on Communication System Theory by Baghdadi. You go to any good RF engineer from the old days and you say, where's your copy of Baghdadi? Called Lectures on Communication System Theory. And you go to the section on limiters, and that section probably goes on for 30 or 40 pages explaining to you all the goods and bad things that a limiter can do for you and how to design them. So there's a whole art and science to what a limiter can do and what benefits it can buy for you. And there's other techniques by which you can use a limiter in the radar world. I would go there right now. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, you covered it very well, but I'm going to have to boil it down, or some people are going to tell me it was a little too much. I will just tell you a limiter, basically, why it's there. That basically, limiter is an amplifier, but it has to have one other thing, that it has to have a predetermined point where it stops so that it will not. So when a signal increases beyond the preset point of the limiter, the limiter overload and just stops amplifying. That's what it's there for. So, it also, like Dick says, you have a situation where noise, and that's what we call chopping. That you may see that term. It chops most of the noise and amps through modulation from the incoming signal. That's what basically the limiter is. And usually the limiter is not one. It's a, you know, number of little circuits put together, but both, they basically, that's what they are, little amplifiers with predetermined cutoff points. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mel just mentioned something very nice. If I was making a graph of the output voltage versus input voltage of an amplifier, and this was an ideal amplifier, I'm plotting input voltage horizontally, I'm plotting output voltage vertically on this XY graph, an ideal amplifier, the response of the amplifier would be a 45 degree straight line, going right to the origin of that graph. That's an ordinary, purely linear amplifier. A limiter will have that 45 degree line in the middle of the graph, but when the 45 degree line approaches, in my example, plus 1 volt, the 45 degree line slants over to a pure horizontal line from 1 volt up and all the way out to the right. It stays at 1 volt. And the same thing in the negative direction. It goes to minus 1 volt and then becomes a horizontal line. So it's a horizontal line slanted 45 degrees in the middle and another horizontal line. That's the transfer characteristic of an ideal limiter. And with modern day solid state circuits, you'd be amazed how close you can come to that characteristic. So as you can tell, in my example, beyond 1 volt of output of this circuit, no further increase takes place. It clips, it hard clips at plus 1 volt, and that's the transfer curve you would get from an ideal limiter. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Sensitivity of your FM receiver is many times rated in the amount of signal required to produce, you know, what we call a given amount of quiety. And most of the ARRLs, you'll see they use a, I think their standard is 20 dB. I believe that that's, am I correct, Dick? Over.
Decibels of quieting. A real FM receiver with no signal going in, you hear quite a bit of rushing noise, a broadband Gaussian noise coming out of the loudspeaker. You put in a dead, unmodulated carrier right on the center frequency. Receiver for a ham radio operation might be 0.1 microvolt. You apply a signal of 0.1 microvolt, which is minus 127 dBm, 127 dB weaker than a milliwatt, and that receiver, the audio vacuum tube voltmeter, or your Hewlett-Packard model 400 voltmeter connected to the loudspeaker, the dial goes down by 20 dB in noise power when you plug in that 1 dB, that's a 0.1 microvolt carrier signal that I just described. That's the old days. Well, they suddenly realized that there's a better technique called SINAD, signal to noise and distortion, and now they look for 12 decibels of SINAD. I won't explain what that means, but it's very similar to the same spec. It's very similar to the old technique of 20 decibels of noise quieting, but it's a way of rating the signal sensitivity, call it noise figure, of a high quality FM receiver. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick just said, when you get a certain amount of signal, basically, make it very simple, you get a sufficient amount of signal arrived at the receiver to start the limiting action. The radio just quiets down. That's what it is. And it seems like all of a sudden, the background noise even disappears. So there you are. That's basically what we're talking about in very short, simple terms. All right, Dick, if you want to go, you can go on with the TechNet. That's about all I have, I think, pressing over.
Yeah, because of the limiter characteristic that's true in almost every reasonable quality FM receiver, that limiter will one constant amplitude. The net result of that is that when it comes to FM transmitters and FM receivers, you can operate both of them simultaneously in the shack with you. You take your FM receiver, it might be a handy talkie, plug in a set of earphones, put the earphones on your head, walk over to a separate transmitter, and start transmitting into it. The FM receiver in the shack with you is much higher than it has to, but because of the phenomena of the limiter, you can listen to what's coming out of your earphones, you can rate the quality of what's coming out of your transmitter that's in the shack with you, and you can do a darn good job with rare exception. It'll tell you exactly, is there enough pre-emphasis, is the mic gain set high enough, is the speech clipper doing its correct job. You can rate an FM receiver in the shack with you. Let me drop. Sideband transmitter. You try rating the quality of your single sideband by having a receiver in the shack with you while you're transmitting in the same shack. You cannot do that, because the signal getting to the receiver is so extremely strong, because the audio demodulator circuit starts acting in a very nonlinear manner, and you might end up getting feedback. The little bit of noise coming out of the earphones gets fed back to the microphone, and the whole system goes into squealing and all kinds of yucky sounds. If you want to know the quality of the sideband, you put it back to you, or maybe he can play it over to you over the telephone. But in the same shack, amplitude modulation, it's almost impossible to simply listen to it yourself. Yes, you can play it on an oscilloscope. And with care, there's ways you can hear your own sideband signal in the shack with you. But just simply setting up a receiver and a transmitter, you can't do it. But with FM, you can do it. You can listen to yourself when you transmit, and you can rate the quality of what you're transmitting. I bet some of you guys out there have done that. If so, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. Go right ahead.
So doing, I could really critique what my sideband audio sounds like. Over.
And what you had to do that, John, is to make an extremely low sensitivity receiver, direct conversion, that can tolerate very strong. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. Just wanted to see something here. I bet you've got a pretty fancy website if I know you, John. Yeah, sure enough. Lots of detail when it comes to your biography. And those guys in Seagirt, you got to get up pretty early in the morning to fool them. So, yes, you can design a receiver that can tolerate very strong signals. And maybe it's a very well-shielded signal, that receiver. So that way you can rate the sideband quality. But to ordinarily do it, I mean, a guy who's got two transceivers in the house, and one's connected to a dummy load and one's connected to an antenna, and he hopes he doesn't overload one to the other. Under normal circumstances, to hear the quality of your own sideband in your own shack is quite difficult. You probably discovered that, and you went through this process. I wonder if you've ever written an article on that one, John, because lots of guys really should hear what they sound like over the air, because some of them, there's definite room for...
K2RIW on the TechNet from KD2BD. No, I haven't written anything up on that, but I agree. It would probably raise the eyebrows for quite a number of people. The reason why I went with that approach is because back in 2003, I built an Elecraft K2 transceiver, and I wanted to get the BFO injection point relative to the crystal filter just the right level so that I would sound the same on upper sideband as I would on lower sideband. And putting together that little receiver made it very easy for me to do that, because there was no filtering in the receiver. And in fact, what I've even done is I've even transmitter and captured that audio through a sound card on a computer, and actually done plots of the response and the ripple of the sideband filter. K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Speech intelligibility and good punch through and whatever, the right kind of speech clipping, it's an art form to do it right, and not many people have done it right. Some of the filters that we've used, we think we want a super narrow filter, 1.8 kilohertz wide, and we think it's going to really slice through a pileup on the 20 meter band. And maybe it does, but it also has very limited intelligibility. 1.8 kilohertz is restricted. the sibilance that really allows you to know when one word ended and another word is beginning is not there. Therefore, you have to use a... You're doing so much mental processing, you're going to end up with a lot of fatigue that's not easy to explain, if you know what I mean. Having full fidelity is an awful lot nicer. And it likes the speech filter, the sideband filter, to be flat across the top. Let me drop... And you'd like it to have a certain kind of control to the slopes and so on. You'd be amazed how many of the transmitters we can buy in the past, where you tune it to the upper sideband mode, you get one particular characteristic, you flip the switch to the lower sideband mode, and it's got an entirely different characteristic. Sometimes they're using the exact same filter twice. They really should be using a second filter. And you use the filter that's intended, that's designed for upper sideband modulation, and you don't flip that filter around. You just try to reuse it for the lower sideband. I know that... I'm trying to remember which rig used that. Yaesu 221R, I think, did something like that. And its sideband on the lower sideband mode was pretty yucky. In sideband with good speech intelligibility, it requires some care. In the microphone circuit, the speech clipping circuit, the sideband filter. If you could switch over to a 4KC wide filter when you're holding a local rag shoe with somebody, assuming you've got a quiet portion of the band of 6 meters or 2 meters, it's a much more pleasant voice to listen to. I bet you run into some of these characteristics, John. KD2BD, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, roger. K2RIW in the TechNet from KD2BD. My challenges were to actually get my the 3 or 6 dB bandwidth of the crystal filter and the transceiver. The transceiver uses, I think, a 7 crystal ladder filter. And I made some changes to the coupling capacitors within that filter to try to broaden it out a little bit and to reduce some of the passband ripple. And I did that, and it sounded better, but I still felt as though it seemed a little bit narrow. So I went through the whole commotion of putting that little receiver together and writing some software to do an audio sweep and sample the audio coming out of the receiver to plot a graph. And what I found is that I was still getting a little bit less than the advertised bandwidth. I'm getting maybe 2.2 or 2.3 kilohertz. But that, in combination with the microphone response, in combination with my voice quality, all those sorts of things, really makes it an art form to find out what the correct BFO injection point is. And with that, W in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Glad to hear that somebody is putting the effort into putting out some clean signal on the air, and you say, hey, is there something about that signal? Boy, that sounds nice. It's pleasant to listen to. It's got just the right speech quality, if you know what I mean. Sounds like broadcast. And what they've got to do in the broadcast studio to make a person sound good, not quite as easy... Space shuttle that's going to go to a museum goes into your town, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, let me wait for the phone. Waiting for the courtesy on WS2N. Okay, Dick, a couple of topics, if I have it. Okay, very good. The satellite, there's a satellite aboard the International Space Station, ARISS. Amateur Radio International Space Station. The satellite's been sitting on board for quite a while. This thing is very similar to a couple of few years ago. They had something called a SuitSat, which was a Russian spacesuit that wasn't needed anymore, and they put a transmitter in it and pushed it outside, and you were able to copy this thing for quite a few days for It was on the ham frequencies, and this is an extension of that. Well, this time they're not using a spacesuit; they're actually using a satellite. It looks like it's about 18 inches wide by about 6 inches deep, and they loaded it up with batteries and components and all kinds of stuff, and antennas, and have a transmitter on board, and also a receiver. This time, you're going to be able to. Okay, and centimeter up and 2 meter down. They call it the UV mode, and it's going to go out on one of the Russian EVAs, EVA 29. That's their 29th EVA mission for the space station. So it's got a CW beacon on it. Be transmitting on 145.919 and also on 145.939. And this thing probably will go for, I guess, a couple of months or whatever before it deorbits. So I thought I'd bring that up. You could always go to the AMSAT website to get further details. Figure out how to track the thing, and you'll know when it's coming over the head, that, to be able to either talk to it or to at least listen to the CW ID. Or they also have a slow scan TV deal that's involved in that whole setup as well. There, I want to bring that up. The main thing I want to bring up is the gyroscopic topic. I'm gonna drop it. Okay, last week we were talking about the gyroscope that is going to be used on the James Webb Space Telescope, and whether or not they're going to be standard gyros that they use on a lot of spacecraft, such as the Hubble. Well, it turns out they're not. On the Hubble, you have 6 gyroscopes. You need at least 2, usually 3, to keep it operating. And these are spinning things with they're measuring every time it changes a little bit, they could fire little thrusters or whatever. We'll put on gyro momentum wheels or whatever to move the Hubble one way or the other. And it has to be very accurate. And, of course, they break down. They've been changed a number of times over the years. So the question, I think John had it, what type of gyros are the James Webb Space Telescope going to have? This thing is going to be out at the L2 position, or Lagrange point number 2, which puts it 1 million miles out, roughly 4 times space shuttle or anything that would be able to make it up there. We don't have a space shuttle, but we don't even have it in 10 years. Drop it. Lead. They're looking at another 7 years. Whatever. Seen these things, Dick? I hope you have, because this thing weighs a 0.5 pound. They put a whole bunch of them, I think about 4 of them, on the James Webb Space Telescope. And it consists of really 3 parts, really not really any moving parts. No spinning things. What you have is this wine-shaped glass type of thing made out of piezoelectric, quartz. It sends off a standing wave. And you've got these pick-off electrodes, which are really nothing but more quartz.